You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and each week I will bring you guests that will inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. I will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. Now, having over 30 years experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields and authors sharing valuable stories and helpful information who are working to keep your family mentally, physically, and spiritually sound and make this world a better place for all of us. And I'll continue to bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, our guest today, Roy Diamond, was not always a writer. For most of his adult life, he was a youth worker, working with families that were struggling or children who were having a hard time. In the 30 years working with families, he learned that no matter how difficult life is, if one can answer, "Who am I?" and "What do I believe in?" then the lessons that the universe is teaching will be learned. Now, that led him on a journey halfway around the world and back. And when he returned, he began writing. Roy wrote The Singing Bowl, a novel about one man's search for a book lost to the world. The Rubicon Effect, a novel about humanity being forced by the end times to discover if they are driven by hope or fear. And Saving Our Pennies, his first work of nonfiction, which is a story of one person's struggle to find a better life and the mentor he finds along the way. Joining Roy is his co-author, Jeff Leach, a teacher of 18 years who first met Roy when Roy spoke to aspiring teachers about the profession. Jeff worked with Roy prior to his retirement from youth work and told us that those few years spent with Roy in the educational forum working with at-risk youth has served as the bedrock of his own career. Saving Our Pennies is his first novel, which he is extremely proud to say that he co-authored with his great friend and educational mentor, Roy Diamond. Jeff also has a story based on his teaching in the well-known series Chicken Soup for the Soul, Children with Special Needs, titled Toss of a Coin. Gentlemen, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for having us on.
It is great to have both of you on. I appreciate you guys taking the time and sharing with us, not only your book but also some of your wisdom of working with kids. Fortunately, we have a lot of listeners who also work with at-risk youth, so I think that that we're really going to have a great show. Now, I think one of the first things I would love is tell us about your new book, Saving Our Pennies. And Roy, what was your inner muse what did your inner muse tell you that made you want to write this book, and why did you choose Jeff as a co-author?
Well, first of all, let me just say hi to all your listeners and wish them, you and your listeners, a happy Easter Monday. It's quite an honor to be on your show, especially on this great day. The Savings Are Penny, it's a interesting little book, in my opinion, because we kind of came to it from a place of friendship. Jeff and I was sort of his mentor when he first began, and very quickly after that, the word friend became a real important part of our vocabulary. And we just kind of kept tossing back and forth ideas of, there's a lot of kids you see in this profession, and I'm sure the listeners out there know about, always losing somebody who just kind of wanders off and you never hear from them again. And what happens to those people? So we wanted to write a book that maybe would inspire people trying to help other people or people who are having trouble, inspire them to maybe find their way back to a better place, a place where they more likely belong. So I think Savings Their Penny came out of friendship between Jeff and I, and a real deep respect for his ability as a teacher. And as far as my inner muse goes, I have to be honest, I think it's more a quick punch in the shoulder all the time from Jeff, as he kept saying, we got to write this book. So if I have an inner muse on this book, I think it was probably Jeff punching me in the shoulder saying, we got to get this done.
So Jeff, how many times did you have to punch him to get him to move forward with this?
Well, it was probably three distinct ones. I first met Roy in my university practicum for teaching, and he just, I remember we'd heard a lot of, people speak, and Roy only spoke to us for an hour, and I was just riveted. So after that, I went to speak with him, and I had to chase him around our school district for a few years because he kept turning me down. I think he knew by the time, the third time I'd asked it, I was really serious about how much I could learn from him, just having the good fortune to listen and be in a couple places where he was working with at-risk youth. And what was unbeknownst to Roy is I already got the job before I asked him the third time. So he didn't have a choice. So it was a fantastic journey just to get to work with him for sure.
Well, that's great. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the book, but first, if you can explain to our listeners, there's a particular sentence from your book called "Stones Are Necessary Sometimes for Balance." Explain what that sentence means.
You're taking a sentence that's probably one of the most core sections of the book and presenting it here, which I really appreciate. That's that sentence is powerful unto itself, and it's an old Aboriginal concept. And basically, the idea, if you pick up a rock and you throw it at somebody and you hit them with the rock, it's pretty clear the damage and pain that you cause. And I think people forget that words have weight. They're real. They're just as real as a knife in the side or a stone to the forehead. And I think if you can use your words carefully and give consideration to them and realize that every word that you put out there has an impact, I think you start speaking more carefully. And so that's one benefit of that concept. The other benefit is we have choices. When people give us their words, consider them as stones. Some rocks and pebbles and boulders you want to hold on to. They're advantageous. They keep you real. They hold you to the ground. They center you. But other times, if you carry too many words that other people give you, you get weighted down. And you can't fly to your dreams, and you never really do find your own vision. You're only kind of carrying the stones of somebody else. So I know when I was doing counseling, I often told people to consider the words that have been given to them in their past, maybe from parents or teachers or friends or whoever, and make a decision. This is a good stone. These are important words. These have value. They have weight. They're real. And I'm going to hold on to those stones. But these stones over here, I don't think that they're helping me at all. And I have a choice. I can carry them around, and they can weight me down, and I can, have them for the rest of my life. Or I can simply take them and put them by the side of the road and move on down the road and be a little less weighted down. So I think it's a beautiful Aboriginal concept of the value and importance of words.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, it's Roy spoke very eloquently about it there, but it's that idea that it keeps coming back to us, and as you move down that road, like you have your life's backpack, and you carry some stones in there to keep you honest, as Roy says, for weight and to center you, and then there's times you look at those stones and you finally put them down on the ground, and you move along a little further down your road and your journey, and that theme was so prevalent as Roy was leading 30 years of youth work, and I was just about my fifth or sixth year, pretty new to the profession at the time, and that was such a reoccurring theme for our students that would disappear, and then they'd look like they'd been pulverized by an avalanche some days coming in to see us, and then when we saw them just have those moments, those epiphanies of I don't want to be this anymore. You could just literally see these rocks fall off them. It was absolutely magic, and it still holds true to this day for what we're seeing via the families and the the kids in the classroom as well.
Yeah, and I think you bring up some beautiful points, both of you, because, especially in this day and age, I mean, we are literally bombarded with information, and you have now kids that are not just getting information from their parents or from the television, but with the internet, you're getting so much stuff that is coming out. People can, from afar, literally, throw some pretty ugly stones and do it kind of in a cowardly fashion. They don't have to come up and look at you to say or to do something or to try to plant a seed or to tag you with something. And I think that's a great way that you've put it is this: tell them they don't have to keep those. They can let them go right by. I think you bring up a really good point in getting the kids to look at it that way.
I think that's too, Alan, is another point you make there is something I didn't deal with as much because I'm just newly retired and out of the profession, but I'm seeing my wife as a counselor, and she's seeing a lot more cyberbullying than I ever saw, and that's a whole different, really gutless, really just that anonymity is just gives the coward so much courage, and that's something I never dealt with, and I think Jeff probably deals with it more than I do now, but you're absolutely right. The cyberbullying now is I hope only a phenomenon that doesn't last for a long time, but I kind of think it'll be around for a while.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, let's talk a little bit about Penny. What was the point that impressed you the most about Penny to make her the main character of your book?
Oh, I'll have to take that one because I was the one that met Penny. Penny was just a glowing, wonderful, bouncy, energetic, full of life, little grade, I think probably about grade 4, grade 5 girl. And just the glowing person in the classroom, she just stood out. She was so full of life. And as we don't use her specifically in the book, we kind of try to make a composite person there. But at the back of the book, we do tell her story, and I don't mind sharing it here. But it's to share sort of the horrific, so for insight only, not to make light of what she experienced. But I knew her as just a great kid. And then one day out of the blue, she just went home at lunchtime, as she always did. And she just, on such bad luck, she just walked in the house as her father committed suicide. And, it was noon, and she had to sit there until we finally realized she hadn't come back from school and go and look for her. And we found her like an hour later just sitting beside her dad as he bled out. And she stopped talking and never spoke again for a good solid 10 months. And I've never seen such a dramatic shift in a human being in my life, just this boisterous girl to absolute dead silence. And I have to say, the school I worked in, I'm so proud of that school. The principal, he was just magnificent. The teachers, the other students, I mean, she was so well-liked. They just gathered around her, eh? And we all took tasks. Sometimes teachers could see something was bothering her, and they'd just stop their lesson plan. The curriculum could be put on the sidelines, and basically, let's do something else that's fun and just try to get her involved. The principal, every lunch hour for 10 months, he took her and just sat with her in a quiet room and just read stories to her. She was a great reader from before, and he just simply sat and read to her. And the beautiful thing was the story ended one day. We were doing a tea in the staff room for the parents were putting it on for the staff, and kids were bringing us food and stuff like that. And just, I was just the lucky one. That's all it was. She turned to me and she said, "Hi, Mr. Diamond, do you want any tea?" And she hadn't spoken for 10 months. And I always remember the glass shattering as her mom was there helping us. And the glass shattered on the floor, and she just dashed over and gave her a big hug. And the whole staff and the principal and myself, when she graduated, we all lined up at the back wall and watched this, again, boisterous, energetic, full of life grade 12 student go across and get her diploma. And it just was so impactful to see somebody in one moment, their life shattered. But they were able to work their way out of it. And I think we took a lot of the things that the courage and the energy that Penny had to work her way out of it and the support of the people around her. And we tried to represent that in our book. And so the story ends beautifully. She went on successful in her life and became the person that she was. I think one of the saddest things in our profession is to see people who, you know, if they were raised by maybe another family or if they had different circumstances, they'd be happy. And there was Penny, who was happy and then not happy. But through great effort on everybody's part and especially on her part, she became happy and became the person she was meant to be. So that's who Penny was.
Well, that's beautiful, and yeah, and what I hear you saying, and the beautiful part is that, you know, the happiness was there. She found it again, and
yes,
and that's beautiful. We have an email that has come across, and this one reads: I buy so many books recommended on Alan's show because they have the cream of the authors with heart and great messages. Yours is one of the most interesting ones so far, as it reminds me of an event last Christmas when our little 9-year-old granddaughter was quietly sitting at the dining table during a big family dinner. Several of the adult family members were complaining about the issues that they were having with their teenagers. She raised her hand and literally floored us by asking, "Are you listening to what they have to say about your problems that they are having to deal with? Maybe you should stop complaining about them and fix yourselves." Wow. I'm getting chills just reading it. So, and then it goes on to say, "Out of the mouth of babes came a message we are all still talking about and probably will for a very long time. In fact, it is one that has helped each generation step outside ourselves and think about how others perceive us." Wow.
That's magic.
Yeah.
That's really
Gentlemen,
fantastic.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, Roy, I'll grab this one here if I could. Feel free to add, but it just speaks to the heart of the what these little people can bring to us, how much consciousness they bring. You know, these students that walk through our doors, sometimes the teacher, and for good reasons too, has, you know, is an authority figure, but the amount we can learn from these people is phenomenal, and they are wise. And they're honest, sometimes brutally honest.
Yeah.
but just absolutely magic in how they see the world and even what they've gone through. Email or that was sent to you, Alan, reminds me of just some of the students that we've seen over time, and I'm sure the families that you've seen over time, that it's just fantastic and amazing that through it all, they come to school, they come to find a place, and they still find a way to smile, and how much we learn from that. It's amazingly energizing, and like your listener had written there, that'll be remembered forever. Just the fact that someone could see through everything and just to set the agenda straight and say, "No, this is it. Have you heard yourself?"
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've got a question for both of you. Both of you having worked with, with young people. So, in your career as youth workers, you've obviously helped many people, which, as many of our listeners have. How did helping others help you in your own life?
Yeah, so that it's it goes to one of the words Jeff used in his response, and I think that's consciousness. I think just even the mere act of bending down to listen, to hear another's problems, in some level, it must raise your own consciousness. I think that little girl that spoke so beautifully there, and thank you to that listener for sending that in, it really goes to who's helping who. You know, like those adults are all busy trying to solve their problem but it's often the person who knows the situation best who can help the people who are trying to help them. I often say when I was doing counseling that if I could just hear what the other person is saying, they almost always told me the answer. They just needed to have a reflecting mirror or something to bounce off of to hear their own words. So I think often whenever you try to do something good and decent and honorable in the world, you get unbelievable reward back from that. It comes in a million different ways, and often we don't even realize it. But to the point of your question of how does it help us is, I think as long as you're trying to do something, if your intentions are good, then you get so much good back, even if it's just that I felt good about myself because I tried to help somebody. And that gives you a little more consciousness, and that little girl, I think, gave a whole entire room quite a bit of consciousness. I think if you try to help somebody, you're really ultimately deep down helping yourself.
Yeah, Jeff.
Well, with intention. Well, from what I learned from Roy early on, and in the time I did spend with him in that the at-risk program, I intention and compassion were words I that came up over and over, and the courage to give the right message to someone and in their darkest time, and it was really fascinating just to see that in Roy's program. This is what you had me thinking about with your question too, because as I went to work with him and I had the permission of students to be there with him, sometimes I didn't speak a word, and when I could, I offered what I thought was going to be beneficial. But it's just unbelievable when you treat someone with dignity, to have the courage and the kindness to give them the right message, and that they matter, and that they exist, and that they're important, and you don't ignore them. It just lends itself to identity and just the magic of what Roy's saying there, the power of intention. And that's really what it comes down to. It seems like that's all we really control, good or bad intentions. Mm-hmm. And just seeing students, you know, slumped on the table sobbing to, you know, that, like I say, that moment where they're like, I don't want to be this anymore. And you almost thought that the words they were given as advice kind of made it push them over the edge, having them, you know, look at themselves in the mirror and see who they were, and then they... And all of a sudden, you know, what I really learned from Roy is he strapped on some wings on these kids. When I thought, oh boy, this is pretty big. And all of a sudden, they're smiling right through their tears. They're like, you know what? I don't want to be this anymore. I want to be this. And that was so powerful. And that to me encompasses the essence and the spirit of Penny in this book. Not only through the eyes of children, but through the eyes of adults in the novel. Like those characters, it's so powerful, and we really tried to capture that because it just happens, as mm-hmm. your listeners and yourself know, across this planet, about families and generations trying to understand each other and trying to move forward. And it's like I say, it really does speak to where that intention, I find the word compassion also is married to that word, to have the courage to give those messages.
Well, if you want to learn more about Penny, the book is called Saving Our Pennies. We're talking with Roy Diamond and Jeff Leach. We're going to take a break. We will be right back. Stay with us.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shield specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. we offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. We're talking with Roy Diamond and Jeff Leach. The book is called Saving Our Pennies. You know, when we started, we've been talking a lot about mentors. And how many of us, you know, can become mentors of all ages, and what we can learn from young people, what young people can learn from older people. We have another email message that has come in, and this one reads, the Boy Scout troop I work with has been working with the elderly in our community this last year, helping with outdoor chores like raking leaves, lawn cleanup, and gardening. These kids have really connected with these seniors and are coming back to troop meetings sharing really interesting stories and histories of these folks. I think this is a missing piece in today's society. What is your opinion about this?
That's another great email. You know what I've found? I have three children, myself, Alan, 22, 20, and 10, and throughout their lives, they've had those connections and those experiences through school. And what is absolutely amazing is what I found. Roy alluded to earlier about the technology these kids always seem to have in their hands. And they're always on, like they never get any relaxed time. Uh-huh. And they put those away, and they're working with these seniors, you know, and they have time to have actual conversations, maybe longer conversations than they get with their own family just because of the busyness of life. But actual planned, scheduled time where they're doing something, and they're maybe, you know, sitting down and talking while they're raking up their garden when, you know, someone could have a bad back and watching them. But they're becoming just more human again. Everything seems to be more real. The world slows down, and we start having these conversations. And it's such an amazing piece, because that smile, that thank you, it's genuine, you know. And maybe they're sitting down having some lemonade after, and it's been great. But the times my own children have gone through it, and I think that's fantastic.
And Roy, do you have anything to add?
Just that the wise statement there from the listener, the missing link, is it's sadly in my travels one thing that really stood out. I've had the good fortune to see a good chunk of the world, and this is a North America phenomenon. This removing our elders, this doesn't happen in the rest of the world, and I think the rest of the world reaps the benefits of that. The elders are still dominant in the home, as opposed to being placed in a home. I think you go through all your life and you have all these life experiences, and just when you're at a point where you should be allowed to turn around and share them back with the younger generations, basically they get removed. We separate them out. We almost cull them from society and put them in homes and put them in, you know, all these places. And that it doesn't happen in the rest of the world. You travel any place else and the families are together. It's crowded, it's noisy, and, you know, grandfather and grandmother, They're the dominant people in the house. It's not mom and dad, or as in North America, it was often the case. The kids are the dominant ones, and I think we all know kids aren't ready for that rule. But if there's nobody there to teach them, you know, they're just losing a great huge amount of intelligence and wiseness and insight. And so your listener is absolutely right. It is absolutely a missing link for sure.
And Roy, we're talking about obviously mentors, and Jeff refers to you as one of his mentors. Who was your mentor, and what can you tell us about him or her?
Well, I think everybody who finds some insight into life at some place has bumped into somebody that they can call a mentor. And one of the real losses in my life was I never had the opportunity for Jeff to meet my mentor. And I think, I say in the book, I think that there's a direct line from my mentor to me to Jeff, and then to whoever is searching to find Jeff. And it can be his own son or a colleague or a complete stranger, but there's somebody out there right now searching for some answers that Jeff has. And if he's lucky and earns it and his intentions are honorable, I think they will meet. So it's a tremendous break in that line for me to not have had the chance to introduce Jeff to my mentor. But he was a teacher. We use him in the book as a colleague of the main character, and basically you can see a lot of his qualities in the book. He was one of the smartest men I ever met. He could quote Shakespeare, any great English literature he had at the tip of his fingers, and yet he had his nose will always stand out to me because he was a boxer and he came up from the mean streets of England and Edinburgh, I believe, and he was a tough man. When I met him, I was probably 30, 35 and in pretty good shape. And he was probably 55, and I would never ever cross him because he would have smacked me real fast. Tough man, and at the same time, one of the gentlest souls I've ever met. His gift to me and why I was fortunate to call him a mentor was he had the great gift of taking anything that was complex. And we would meet probably once a month in the pub for a beer and just talk about life. And if I had a problem, I could take it to him. And he always made me, it, to some degree, feel foolish because he would answer my big, important, serious, complex problem with the simplest of answers, the most fundamental truth. And he just had this ability to cut through the nonsensical stuff to the core. And he would not solve my problem, but he would give me insight so that I could see it from a different perspective with the simplest of concepts. And that's what Jeff was saying. When we were working together, we always talked to the kids about compassion, about doing the right thing. These are not complex concepts. Uh-huh. These are fundamental and core. And my mentor had the gift of just cutting right through to that.
You know, Roy, as you were saying that, it had me thinking of my father, who's no longer with us, and we used to meet once a week for lunch near his office, and we would sit and talk about life, or talk about anything, and I was very young, and I would bring my problems, and when you mentioned about breaking everything down to a very simple thing, there was one time I can recall where I was talking about a relationship problem, with the person I was involved with at that time, mm-hmm. and he, I told him, here's my problem. I don't know if I should do this or if I should do this. And he sat there and he held his chin and he took a deep breath and he thought about it for a moment and he said, that's just one of those big guy decisions you're going to have to handle on your own.
Yes. True, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. But that's and as you were telling that story, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Was, there are some times in which, you just need to put on the big boy pants and make that decision, and move forward. So yeah. Anyway, it brought a smile to my face.
It's nice that you have that memory. Eh? It's a great memory.
Mm-hmm. So now let's going back to saving our pennies. If there was one message, if there was one point that you would want anybody that's reading that book to take away from it, what would it be?
Well, I honestly think maybe it's the way Roy and I see our day, but I would venture to say most people do, is that you never, ever give up. There is, even in the darkest hours, there's hope. There's a way to find, there's a way, somehow, some way. And the great part about the book is understanding that you have to take responsibility for your life and you have to trust someone. And I think that's a real big piece of the essence of all of us. Going right back to your points, Ellen, about what do we, who are we, and what do we believe in? And it's the cog that really drives the story, and I think drives our lives for sure.
Okay, and I've got one really for both of you, and again, because I sort of look at it and I say, you know, we all sort of come from the same field, the working with at-risk youth, and as we have a lot of listeners that do the same, can you each share from your experience as working with youth, how do you see the younger generation today, and what is your advice for the young people and their families when they find themselves in a difficult situation where there doesn't seem to be a simple or easy solution?
Yeah, that's such a big one, because it has to do with the now. I think that the younger generation, they are so much more than we were, but unfortunately, they are also so much less than we were. I think there's a culture that has developed around the young people that has isolated them from us. And I think that's one of the biggest problems I had as a counselor, was having them come and talk to me and get them to understand that friends are great to talk to, and they're great to you know, share your feelings with, but their friends are also there basically to commiserate with you, and your friends don't have the wisdom and the life experiences to offer solutions or ways out of the darkness. And I think as long as we have this culture where my friends are first and my friends are everything, and that's our fault. That's adults' fault that we've allowed that culture to permeate. Our messages become less important, and all of a sudden you've got kids who, whatever their friends think or whatever their colleagues or classmates are doing or thinking is the most important thing. And it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that, you know, what your family thought, that was first and foremost, without a doubt. I mean, you had friends and you had colleagues who you listened to and you commiserated with them, but it's on a different scale. It's a different culture now. And I think saving our pennies, we're trying to basically say that the solution lies within you, and you need to have a mentor. You need to have somebody that you trust, as Jeff says, to talk to, so that you have, and this is a very important word in the book for us, is you have the energy to find a way out. If you commiserate with people, quite often that just sucks the energy out of you. You feel like you've been wronged. You get lots of information that you have been wronged, and you become a victim. You become poor me, and it's everybody else's fault. But in truth, to find happiness, to find your way out, you've got to accept responsibility, and you've got to say, I've got the energy. In the back cover of the book, we use the example of mentors are everywhere. Maybe the old man sitting beside you on the bus who's always smiling. The answers, the solutions are all around us, but you will never find them if your culture tells you that you're a victim and everybody you're commiserating with tells you you're a victim. You won't have the energy to look outside and find people who can help you answer the questions, who am I and what do I believe in? I think that individually, the kids today, they're so bright, they're so smart, they have so much information at their disposal. But as a culture, I worry deeply, particularly in North America, that it's just a lost culture, and it has to change, and it's the adults that have to change it. My own personal opinion, is one of the worst things education ever did was when the teachers became guides on the side, and kids became more controlling of their own education. I think we literally took a step away from our own children when we did that. And I think adults need to step up and say, there's another culture out here, in the internet culture and the Twitter culture. These aren't necessarily the only cultures that we believe in something else.
Yeah.
And Jeff?
Well said by Roy there. The only part I would add, Alan, is that in my 18 years here, of teaching, I've really been baffled and blown away by the blurring of the lines between adults and who a lot of them, not necessarily teachers, but just people in my community who want to be friends with their kids and don't want to lead. They don't want to pass that torch to the next generation. It's a huge responsibility, and it's been lost. This is my own thing. It might not be anybody else's, but just in terms of calling someone Mr. and Mrs. something instead of their first name all the time, I've always had a tough time with that. My own parents said, no, that is Mr. and Mrs., and unless they say otherwise, it is always Mr. and Mrs., and that level of formality to help guide the kids. And kids are fantastic. I mean, they're just amazing in what they do. I just come back a couple days ago from a school play, and you know, just the magic those kids, and, you know, they're showing, you know, look at us, and if we don't mentor them, and these kids had a mentor in that play, a wonderful director, and they followed, and he let them find their way. But they always knew who was in boss, who was in charge, and there was always a huge level of respect throughout the whole process. And boy, when those lines are blurred, and I'm not as well traveled as Roy at all, but that I've really noticed in the last two decades where. Kids see themselves as your peer, and that's really dangerous. We've let them down when we don't have the courage to parent.
Well, we have another message coming in that is right along these same lines, and it says, is there any reason you can think of as to why our public school system does not better utilize a mentoring program in our schools? I feel that both the mentor and the mentee get so much value out of it.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I don't want to just shirk it off as a financial thing, but I know up here in British Columbia, and this speaks to maybe many places in North America, perhaps around the world, that education has to be valued, and you have to care first. There has to be good intention and the caring component in place. Otherwise, nothing works. But there's been a real bleeding out of financing education as well, and I think that's been a real huge piece. We need to pay more professionals to come in, and not just to throw money at it, but to have those people that just, you know, love people, love to educate, want to, you know, pass that torch. And those initiatives of having those other programs where they're working with the elderly who come in, or you're going to a care home where you can create those experiences for kids, those become, you know, so rich in experience because there's a huge level of legitimacy to it. We have a peer tutoring program in our school, and it's wonderful, but sometimes we have a situation where classes are collapsed and they just move kids because we can't run a class because of finances, and they move them all into peer tutoring or into a mentorship program who might not be ready for that moment. And so there's some financial dynamics that we're also seeing across this province. But that to me, it has to matter to so many. It has to matter to all of us that we have these processes in place so that we can legitimize those mentorship programs.
And Roy,
To add to that, I think the word that keeps coming to my mind as I listen to Jeff is intentions, and it comes down to priorities and do we care? And bottom line is, who are we and what do we believe in? If we care about children, if we care about education, we prioritize it higher. The money and the funding is there. We have more ability to do things for bringing in mentors or just having the time because we have the staff to introduce a mentoring program among the students themselves. All these things are doable. It just comes down to what do we believe in. And if we don't, if we think one of the phrases Jeff came up with in our book is where we started with the schoolhouse and right now we're going to the warehouse and the next step is the outhouse. And that's absolutely true. When I was in schools, I worked in schools. When I left the education system, I was working in warehouses. We used to have meetings where we discussed kids. Now, when I left, we had meetings where we were discussing the school. What were we going to do with the school? What's in the best interest of the school? And I think as long as you do that, you're missing the most important people, like the little girl in the dinner there. We're forgetting to listen to the people that we should be listening to, and we start listening to each other. And I think. If our intentions are not that children are important, we value them in our society, then we will pay a huge price for that. So I think your listener is absolutely right. Mentoring programs, all that sort of thing, they're fundamental. But do we care enough to do it?
Well, I couldn't have said it any better. I completely agree. We need to be putting the money out there to get our best and our brightest out there working with our kids. And for those that are cutting budgets and things, thinking that somehow this is going to save money, it's not going to save money. It's going to cost us more on the other end. Because yeah, we're going to be paying more, not just emotionally. If the people making the decisions want to look at it as a financial thing, then guess what? We're going to be paying more for private prisons. We're going to be paying more for psychiatric care. We're going to be paying more for so many other things that it just doesn't make sense not to do what we can right now, work with them early, put our best and brightest with them, and raise the type of young people that we know we have amongst us. So, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. I just want to touch on a couple of things real quick, and that is in regards to the book. Again, if you want to find Saving Our Pennies or The Singing Bowl, The Rubicon Effect, whatever, I believe that they are on Goodreads, LinkedIn, Authors Den, Facebook, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, everywhere you can find the book. And so, gentlemen, before we go, what's next for Roy and Jeff?
Well, for me, I'm very happy to say I just signed a contract for my next book. My agent recommended I take the deal, and I have. So I'm looking forward to getting involved with that book. And I also have two other books that were already under contract. They're both children's books. I've never done that before, and my publisher just hired a retired Disney illustrator. So I'm really looking forward to that. So got tons of projects coming down the pike.
That's great. And Jeff?
Well, not as glamorous as Roy, but I do love writing. I do have plans to write another novel, maybe perhaps another co-written book with Roy. I have some ideas, but...
That was a proverbial punch in my shoulder, by the way, Alan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, punch number four on its way, but writing local articles for local papers... In my community, I've always enjoyed doing that, but I definitely have the itch to write some more books with Roy, and possibly try one solo as well.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for coming on. When the new books
thank
are ready,
so much,
please give us a call. We'd love to have you back. Thank you for what you're doing. Keep up the good work. And for everybody
thank
else,
you very much, Alan.
And for everybody else out there, please listen. We have a plea from Darnell, and we're going to close with that. And we look forward to seeing everybody or hearing everybody next week on Answers for the Family. Be good humans. Bye now.
My name is Darnell Young, and I'm desperately reaching out for help. In 1970, after a blood transfusion, my mom contracted hepatitis C, which later evolved into terminal liver cancer. A transplant is her only chance of survival, and we don't have the means to fund the surgery. My stepdad's working as much as he can, and I just got off chemotherapy myself, so I've been limited in what I can do. Any amount you could give would help our family more than you can possibly know. You can go to our fundraising website at youcaring.com. That's youcaring.com and search One Family's Battle, onefamily battle, and you can donate directly there. Don't forget to capitalize the first letter of all those words. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.